The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. Joining us back on the show is Louise Jensen. She's the global number one best-selling author of psychological thrillers The Sister, The Gift and The Surrogate. To date, Louise has sold 1 million books and was nominated for the Goodreads Debut Author of 2016 award. Her latest novel, The Date, is about Alison Taylor, who wakes up one morning with no memory of what happened to her. She doesn't recognise herself or her family and friends. Also joining us is Beezy Marsh. She's an award-winning journalist who writes romantic fiction, memoirs and biographies with family and relationships at the heart of her writing. All My Mother's Secrets is a powerful, uplifting story of a young woman's struggle to come to terms with her family's tragic past. It's set between both world wars. Also with us is M.A. Bennett. She's a history graduate of Oxford University and the University of Venice, where she specialised in the study of Shakespeare's plays as a historical source. The Island is her second book for young adults. It's a dark reimagining of Lord of the Flies for the Trump generation. She asks the question that is on everybody's lips: what makes a good leader? And finally on tonight's show is Laura Marshall, whose first novel, Friend Request, was shortlisted for the Lucy Cavendish Award and the Bath Novel Award in 2016. Her latest novel, Three Little Lies, is about two best friends and one fateful night. What really happened and who is telling the truth? That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Louise Jensen. She's the global number one best-selling author of psychological thrillers The Sister, The Gift and The Surrogate. To date, she's sold approaching 1 million books and she was nominated for the Goodreads Debut Author of 2016 award. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, The Date. Welcome to the book show, Louise.
Thank you so much for asking me.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And I love reading the press release for your book. I read it to people in the office and we all went, ooh.
It just hear that.
it summarizes it so well. So for people who haven't seen the press release, just explain a little bit about the character of Alison Taylor and what happens to her.
Alison's recently separated from her husband and she's persuaded by her friends to go on a blind date through a dating app. And she wakes up the following day covered in blood with no recollection of what's happened to her. And she's had a head injury and that's affected the part of her brain that deals with facial recognition. So she can't recognise herself or any of her family or any of her friends, the date that she went on, and she can't tell when the person who, you know, wants to ruin her life is coming for her, really.
Wow, what an amazing idea. Where did you get the idea from, do you know?
Yeah, I'd watched a documentary on a children's channel years ago with my family that featured a girl called Hannah Reid, and she had a virus that went into her brain when she was 13, and she woke up one day and couldn't recognise anybody. And the documentary followed her as she struggled to adjust to her new life. and there's no cure for the condition, and it really moved me emotionally, you know, as a parent as well, you know, seeing what her parents were going through with her. And so for years I've wanted to write a story about face blindness, but I haven't been able to get it quite right, so it's taken quite a few attempts to get this right. But Hannah's now read this book, and her family have read this book, and that they're all very happy with it and the way it's portrayed. So I'm pleased to be raising awareness for the condition as well.
Oh, fantastic. It's a scary idea, isn't it? What an awful thought for anybody.
Suddenly everybody looks like a stranger. It's really hard to imagine.
Yeah. So you had to do quite a bit of research then, I assume, for this, to find out what actually happens.
Yeah, I do. I spoke to people that have the condition, but I also spoke to a neurologist and made sure I got all the facts right. But it's the emotional side of conditions that interests me. You know, how do people cope? And, you know, you can take one experience and the way people react to that experience is always vastly different.
Mm.
So it's good to kind of do a wide range of research and then kind of place your character somewhere within the facts that you found out.
Mm. It must be difficult to trust anybody.
Yeah, because you don't know who people are. And when I first ran the idea past my editor, she said, but surely from body language and things you would recognise people. And I said, actually, you wouldn't. And I sent her Hannah's documentary to watch, and she just said, I can't imagine it. You know, people, you know, we see faces in a triangular shape, and with face blindness, you can't see that. So it literally, you know, you can't have no way of identifying people. And colours sometimes aren't clear either. So even things such as hairstyles, and of course, you know, when people have short hair, everybody just genuinely does look the same.
Gosh, see, I mean, you'd have to start all over again, wouldn't you, in terms of building relationship with your friends and family?
Yeah, you would. I mean, there's indicators, like we have different voices, and, you know, Hannah said that her ability now to pick up people from voices has improved all the time, because that's the one thing she can rely on. But, she's had to really learn to trust people again and find a whole new way of identifying them.
Mm. So what do we know about the other characters in the book?
We know we shouldn't trust anybody. Yeah, she has a network. She believes she has a good network of friends and family around her, but, you know, there is somebody in the book that isn't acting with her best interests at heart.
Mm. So how did you find the writing process compared to the other books that you've done? Is each book getting easier, would you say?
I thought it was, because my first book was quite an easy write, The Surrogate, but this has been a really hard write, and I think I generally pick a subject, like The Gift dealt with cellular memory and the idea that when we transplant a heart, the memories can be retained so that the recipient will inherit the donor's memories. And I researched that and talked to lots of different heart transplant patients. But that came after the idea that with this Hannah was first and foremost with this idea, and she was a very real person. So I kind of approached it quite hesitantly, you know, really for her wanting to get it right. And, yeah, it was a very difficult book to pull off.
Mm. And how do you think that you come up with, I know that you said you've been inspired by the story of Hannah and the documentary with Hannah for this one, but with your other books and with each future book that you're going to do, is it difficult each time to come up with a great idea like this?
I think it's just finding something that I'm interested in. With The Surrogate, it was, I'd read a story about surrogacy and I couldn't believe how vague the laws are in the UK. There's no laws protecting these prospective parents that are sometimes paying huge sums of money to a surrogate should something go wrong. And I just started looking into the legal side, and that's where that came from. So it's more of a subject I'm interested in, and then the characters will come and the plot.
Yeah.
Follows.
so you don't plan a lot of the plot before you start writing?
I don't know. It sounds a bit cliche to say I like the characters to lead it, but it isn't until I get to know them that I kind of know how they're going to react in situations. So yeah, I like the freedom just to let the book move along at its own pace and do its own thing, and it makes every day exciting when you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting how authors all do it very differently, and whatever works for you makes sense.
Yeah, I've tried to plan, but my mind just can't seem to think ahead that far. So I'm not very good at it.
Yeah. So have you already started on the next book?
No, I haven't started writing it yet, but I've got two characters in my head and kind of a theme. So I'm researching at the moment. I love researching. So hopefully I'll be in a position to start writing soon.
Yeah. Is it difficult sometimes to tear yourself away from the research?
Yeah, and I think because the research is, you know, you start off online and that can lead to Amazon shopping and going off on a tangent and take a lot longer than it should. But, yeah, I find the research fascinating. I mean, still with cellular memory, I'm still looking it up and learning new things. And, yeah, it's good to learn.
So do you tend to, once you start the research, do you tend to do all the research before you start writing, or are you doing it as you go along?
I tend to get my facts right before I start writing, because then I know if there's a story in it. So yeah, I do the majority of it before I start, but sometimes as I write I'll make a note and just say, look this up later. Fill bits in.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Date, it is out now and available to buy in the bookshop section on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Louise Jensen, who we've been chatting to. Louise, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. TRE. Your voice in Spain. Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Beezy Marsh. She's an award-winning journalist who's spent more than 20 years making the headlines in newspapers like the Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. Today, she writes romantic fiction as well as memoirs and biographies, and somehow finds the time to write a blog about her life as an imperfect mother of two young boys. Family and relationships are at the heart of her writing, and she's a firm believer that sisters, mothers and wives are the glue which binds everything together. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, All My Mother's Secrets. It's a powerful, uplifting story of a young woman's struggle to come to terms with her family's tragic past. Welcome to the book show, Beezy.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. So you've been writing for many years, it seems.
I have, yes, but I feel that now I'm really kind of getting into my stride and writing books and kind of combining my journalistic skills with writing a narrative is really, for me, what I want to do, and I feel very fulfilled by that.
Yeah, because writing books is very different to writing articles, isn't it?
It is, but yet, you know, because there's a lot of social history in my books, and All My Mother's Secrets is, you know, it's accurate in terms of the social history of the First World War, the 20s, the 30s. I've been able to use my journalistic research skills and bring those to bear to kind of bring the book to fruition, really. So there is a kind of combination for me of that, you know, writing a story and good storytelling, but actually doing the digging in the background, which hopefully brings the story to life and gives an extra element to my book.
Yeah, absolutely. So even though the stories are fiction, it's important for you to make sure the facts are right.
Well, actually, the story isn't fiction. This is my... that's the other thing. I'm writing faction in that, obviously, I'm writing the story as if we are in World War One or World War Two, but the characters in my books are real, and actually All My Mother's Secrets is my own family story. The heroine of the book, Annie, is my grandmother, and the secrets and the sort of the murky family past and all the covering up that's gone on is real. And that, you know, I have kind of had to delve around through family history records to bring things to light, if you like.
How wonderful. So how did you find out about this side of your family then?
Well, I really grew up in a house full of secrets, where, you know, I would kind of walk into the room as a little girl and my grandmother would change the subject. So I always knew the story from being quite young, that my grandmother's father had gone away to the First World War and never come back. And that was the line that was kind of peddled. And my mother got quite fascinated by family history after my nan, I should say, sort of raised me. So it's quite unusual that she was born in 1905 and I'm now 50. I was born in 1968. So my mum was working, and during the early 70s, my nan and one of my great aunts used to raise me, looked after me and actually lived with us. So I knew all about the history of the slum laundries where they had worked. And I also had this kind of story that was told about, you know, yeah, Nanny's father went away to the First World War and never came back. And she died when I was 13, and my mum then started digging around, sort of trying to find what had happened to her grandfather. And it wasn't until my mum had passed away and I was left with my great aunt, she said something to me which made me think that actually this chap may not have gone away to the First World War and died after all, and there was some other story behind it, and it was to do with a baby, my nan's brother being born out of wedlock. I don't want to kind of spoil the story of the book, but basically there are the sisters. There are two sisters, Emma Chick and her sister Keziah Chick, and there are two brothers, Arthur Austin and Henry Austin, and there's a tragic death of one brother a lot earlier than the First World War, and then there's a tragic death of one sister just at the outbreak of war, and then there's two grieving people, I think, who took comfort in each other and might have had a relationship and produced a child in a community where people judged harshly, and so things were covered up.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're catching my drift there. But,
no, absolutely. And did you get all of this information from your family? You didn't have to make any of it up?
No, I didn't make it up at all, no.
Fantastic.
Basically, I was able to, through the research that I did, I was able to find in the National Archives a record from Arthur Austin, who is the surviving brother, where he is going away to the First World War. He's actually drafted, and because he appealed against his draft, there's a letter from him in which he basically reveals that he is the father of this child. And I was also able to look at electoral rolls through the 1920s, which showed that he was living with my great-grandmother, Emma Chick. So, so it's not a case of making things up at all. The core story is real. What's interesting for me is around and about in the characters that are around and about in the slum laundries are what I'd call composites. So I obviously have known stories from my nan, from my uncles, from my aunts about the characters that worked in these slum laundries in Soapstead Island, and I didn't give people their real names, and I might have combined a few people to make a composite character. So, you know, I can't claim that every conversation that happens in my book is true, because I wasn't there in the 1920s.
Yeah.
But the people are real, or real enough, and actually, through Facebook groups, Acton has its own Facebook group, and going online there are lots of people who are recognising characters and things in my books and saying, oh, you know, this reminds me of my great aunt worked in such and such a laundry. And I also did a lot of history research from the local history society, Ealing Library. There are many, many records about these laundries in Soapstead Island and the way that they worked and how the women lived. So it is, you know, there's a real social history element, and I'm very proud of the accuracy of my work and, you know, really sort of bringing to light an industrial process and a way of living for these working class women that has been lost to us now. Mm. And because they weren't wealthy, they weren't like the Mitford girls, you know, writing letters and leaving papers everywhere. Their history is a kind of more oral history, and things have, you know, potentially been lost for these women. But I think their stories are worth telling.
Absolutely, now. Absolutely. Mm. So how does this book compare to other books that you've done?
Well, it's very similar to, I had an international number one bestseller and a Sunday Times top 10 bestseller called Keeping My Sister's Secret. So the genre and the style, this sort of faction, if you like, narrative nonfiction is what I call it, is very similar to Keeping My Sister's Secrets, which is about three sisters who are, again, based on, they are real people, living in Waterloo in the 1920s and 30s. So that's the other side of London. And we followed them through this turbulent interwar period and right through the Second World War. And so that sort of style of writing was something that people liked, and that's something that I have, you know, I have kind of continued that with the mother's book, yeah. But I have done things that are quite different as well. I have written sort of pure fiction, which is a real joyous romp in a kind of Jilly Cooper-esque vein. I wrote this book called Mr. Make-Believe, which is about a mother who's an imperfect mother, whose life is kind of goes a little bit out of control when she has kids. It's that whole thing, and that's called Mr. Make-Believe, and that's been pretty well received, certainly by, you know, mums juggling, trying to do it all, have a career and have kids.
Yeah. And do you have a genre that you prefer or
well,
really enjoy?
I think I probably really enjoy the sort of the narrative nonfiction, the Keeping My Sister's Secrets, the All My Mother's Secrets, because I've got a real passion for history, social history, and telling people's real stories. I mean, I think I've probably spent my whole life telling people's stories as a journalist in one way or another and listening to people's voices. So, you know, being able to recreate that and also, you know, bring to life a bygone era for me, I think there's something quite special about that. But all writing is just, it's just a joy to me, you know. It's, people say to me, well, how do you make the time to sit down and write? But I don't really sort of think about it like that. I just find it such a pleasure to sit down at my keyboard or put pen to paper. So I suppose that's quite nice, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. And because Keeping My Sister's Secrets did so well, did you feel a bit under pressure with this one?
I kind of did. Someone asked me this the other day, but I didn't at the time. I suppose I do now. I mean, it's done, you know, it's doing very well. I always knew that this story, the All My Mother's Secrets, was in some ways better, actually, than Sisters, because there is a real mystery there and a real... you know, a sort of family secret to uncover. So I wasn't too nervous about it. But then I think when you have any book out there, everybody wants their book to do well, don't they? But you just have to trust that great storytelling and keeping the reader's interest will hopefully find a way, and people will get to hear about your books, and, you know, that's the joy of coming on the radio and doing the promotion, I suppose, that you let... There are so many books out there these days. You know, it's a very crowded market. You've got to hope that people will get to hear about your book or that they'll pick it up and like it. And, I, again, you know, I just feel that gratitude to anyone who takes the time to read my books. You know, without them, I wouldn't have an audience, really, would I?
Yeah. Well, if people want to take the time and pick up the book, they can order it from our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section. It's called All My Mother's Secrets, and it's by BZ Marsh, who we've been chatting to today. BZ, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a real pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio. Europe. Online at tre.radio. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is M.A. Bennett. She's a history graduate at Oxford University and the University of Venice, where she specialised in the study of Shakespeare's plays as a historical source. Her first young adult novel, Stags, was published last year, and her second novel for young adults, The Island, is out now. It's a sort of dark reimagining of Lord of the Flies for the Trump generation. Welcome to the book show, Marina.
Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And what an interesting topic to tackle. Where did this come from?
Well, I thought it was quite timely, really, because we're all sort of wondering what makes a good leader and particularly a good president. So I've got a situation where a society sort of begins from the ground up. So there's a bunch of kids who kind of go on a summer camp and there's a plane crash and they all end up on a desert island. And then people begin to sort themselves out into who is sort of superior, who's inferior, and also the sort of corrupting influence of power. What happens to somebody when they suddenly have power over their fellow man and woman? And so that's what I'm exploring in this book.
Oh, great idea. So tell us about some of the characters. Lincoln is one of the people in the book.
Yeah, Lincoln is a boy who came from America to England with his parents when his parents were posted to Oxford University. So he suddenly finds himself in a very sort of posh public school in Oxford where sport is really, as is the case with a lot of public schools that we now call private schools, actually, as is the case with many of those schools of that type, sport is very, very important. And this is very alien to him because he's essentially a nerd. And I say this with love because I was a nerd at school too. But he's very intellectual. He's interested in science and maths and literature. But he can't do games. He can't do sports. So at this school, he is at the bottom of the food chain. And nothing's working out for him. And as well as that, he's American. He doesn't fit in. Everyone else has got a posh British accent. And then, of course, on the island, we have a situation whereby his skills come into play, and suddenly he finds himself, after 3 years of fairly intense bullying at this school, as the leader of all of the kids that have landed there. And the school bully, who's the jock and the sportsman and the king of the school, essentially becomes his slave. So the whole situation is flipped for Lincoln.
Oh, I love it. that's such a great concept. And I mean, it's interesting to think about how realistic, and I think it would be very realistic if this situation was to happen, how likely it is that that would be the case.
Yeah, that's when you really sort of find out what sort of skills are useful. And I find, I was thinking about this because I have teenage kids myself, and in the sort of Instagram generation where a lot of your status is predicated on your appearance and, you know, how great your life looks and how great you look. And there are issues here of sort of body confidence as well. That those kind of things go away when the chips are down. You know, you really need to, when you have to sort of dig deep and survive, you know, none of those things are important, like how great your dinner looks or how good the gig was that you went to last night or, you know, how much you bench in the gym. It doesn't matter. What matters is, can you light a fire? Can you feed yourself? Can you send a distress signal? And that's what I was exploring here. And then also what happens when, once you've got the necessities of life pinned down, what happens to you then? Do you start sort of having delusions of grandeur? And that's what happens to Link on the island. He begins to want luxuries and he begins to want people to sort of defer to him, and he begins to sort of enslave people. And considering that Abraham Lincoln is the one that sort of abolished slavery, he sort of is the flip of that. He begins to be corrupted by the power that he has.
That's an interesting concept, the whole idea that what can happen to people once they have a bit of power. And I'm sure a lot of people could relate to having seen that happen to someone.
Yes. Indeed, and I think we're all sort of seeing it play out at the moment. In England, we just played host to Mr. Trump, and obviously there are very many issues about him. And one of the issues I also explore in the book is what happens when to women when men are in power, because unlike Lord of the Flies, which I know has been spoken about in relation to this book, which is an enormous compliment to me, but unlike Lord of the Flies, there are girls on this island. And I was asking myself what would happen in the situation where it's mixed. You know, there are girls there too, and boys. And how boys behave to girls when they have power over them. And they think nobody's watching, you know, and they think that they can get away with it. And so I'm sort of exploring that as well.
Oh, fascinating. I bet it was a great book to write, was it?
It was really good fun, actually. Just thinking about how you yourself would act in those situations. how you make your life better for yourself, in that you're using all the things in your armory, like what you're good at, your particular skills, and also questions about teamwork, how good a team player you would be, you know, and what kind of things you would put up with in order to eat or to be comfortable, or, you know, it's really puts the human condition in its sort of rawest sense, you know, when you really have got nothing and you need to sort of work from the ground up.
Was it fun getting into all the different characters' heads and imagining what each person would do and how they would react?
Yeah, very much so. Well, I started with a premise of having kind of different high school tropes or types on the island. And so I have a beautiful girl, you know, sort of a cheerleader girl. I have a jock and I have a geek and I have a high achiever. And they actually call themselves a breakfast club about halfway through the book, because they're obsessed with food and how are they going to eat. And every morning when they wake up, they're like, what's for breakfast? What can we get? And because they're all different types and because they are after their breakfast, I sort of dubbed them the Breakfast Club in the book. And so it was interesting looking at those different high school types and sort of looking beyond that, because we're all sort of in a category. I said it myself, you know, that I was quite nerdy at school and, you know, I was quite intellectual and I wore glasses and all that kind of thing. But everyone beneath that type is different. You know, the pretty girl is often very, very insecure. You know, the nerd always wishes they were cooler. The cool kids wish they were more nerdy. You know, everyone's got their own stuff going on. So it was quite interesting exploring that. Mm. And the other thing for me is that I've never written inside a boy's head before. And though I'm living with a 15-year-old boy, you know, obviously I don't know what it's like to be a boy. So I had to sort of project that. So, I mean, I'm hoping that worked.
Did you speak to your son about it? Did you get any advice from him?
Oh, all the time. Yeah, yeah. I'm shamelessly magpieing from my kids. You know, I'm always trying to get them to tell me what the latest slang is, or, you know, what isn't cool or what is cool. And they're really my conduit to that, because I haven't got a clue. It's a long time since I was a teenager, but they're really, really great at that. They tell me every day how uncool I am, which is helpful.
Nice. So because it's, I think, such a great idea and setting for a story, did you have to plan much of it out before you started? Did you know what was going to happen at the end, or did you just start writing and see where the characters took you?
I knew the end point. I knew where I was headed, and I knew exactly what I wanted the twist at the end to be, because there is a big twist at the end. But along the way, the characters did start to behave quite organically. And once we were on the island, I did find sometimes that they were kind of telling me what they wanted to do, in a way. It sounds really sort of odd. But sometimes, yeah, they did sort of go off on a little bit of a tangent, and which is quite nice, because I suppose on the island, you'd be a bit wild and a bit savage and act out of character. And so some of the characters did begin to sort of bleed off into other directions. And it kind of got darker in places than I planned for it to go, if you see what I mean. Mm. So, yeah, it was quite a nice, surprising, quite sort of savage experience. It was yeah, pretty cool, really.
I know that it's aimed at young adults, but I'm sure a lot of adults will enjoy it as well.
Well, I hope so. I hope so, because these are, I think, subjects that we're all interested in. Mm. And we're all affected by it at the moment, and how we behave to each other has become a bit of a minefield. And I actually don't envy my teens growing up in this world, where it's very difficult to know what the rules are, and it's very difficult to know when you're overstepping the mark. And one of the fun things about writing about the island is that they believe they're completely alone and that they can construct their own society. And what would happen if we have that kind of freedom? And are we all savage, you know, under this veneer of Instagram and success and shiny happy lives? You know, are we all still animals, you know, at bottom? So that was quite fun to play with.
And had you thought about where this island is?
Yeah, I did have to have a careful look at that, because although I'm not massively scientific, I did have to think about things like climate and what resources would be there. And I did actually figure out, I can't say too much about it, I did actually figure out some coordinates as to where the island would be in real life, were this a real story. So I have actually got an idea in my head of where the island is.
But you can't tell us.
No, I'm afraid not.
Well, if people want to get a copy of The Island, I think it sounds like a great story. It's by M.A. Bennett, who we've been chatting to today. Marina, thanks so much for joining us and best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Talk Radio Europe.
Online at tre.radio.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Laura Marshall. After almost 20 years working in conference production, in 2015, Laura decided it was time to fulfil a lifetime's ambition to write a novel and enrolled on the Curtis Brown Creative 3-month novel writing course. Her first novel, Friend Request, was shortlisted for the Lucy Cavendish Award and the Bath Novel Award in 2016. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, Three Little Lies. Welcome to the book show, Laura.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And before we talk about your latest novel, I want to hear about the writing course that you did with Curtis Brown. Was that good?
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. I had this an idea for a book, which was just a very seed of an idea of a woman getting a Facebook friend request from a girl that she'd bullied at school who had supposedly been dead for 25 years. That was all I had, and I didn't really know how to make that into a 100,000-word novel. So I kind of looked around for courses, and there's so many courses. When you Google creative writing courses, there's a million. So I sort of asked advice from a friend, the only friend I knew had any sort of publishing experience, and she recommended this one. And I was lucky enough to be accepted onto it, and it was, it's life-changing for me.
Yeah.
It was incredibly helpful.
So it really takes you through the whole process, does it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it gave me confidence because I'd never really showed my writing to anybody before. So to have, industry people, because obviously my tutor was Erin Kelly, who's an amazing novelist herself, and obviously their agents at the end who look at your work. And so to have people like that to look at my writing and say that it was good, it was an enormous confidence boost for me. I'm not sure I would have ever been able to finish the novel if I hadn't had that encouragement that they gave me. And also just the actual help, the writing advice as well was invaluable. And also I think the other thing it gave me was an understanding of how publishing worked, because, I didn't have any experience, I didn't really know any writers, I didn't know how the whole thing worked. So to get that insight into what agents do and what publishers do and how it all works was also really invaluable.
Yeah, because it's a bit of a minefield, isn't it? People say, the people who haven't written a book before will think it's all about, the process of writing the book is the hardest bit, but often it's getting someone to publish it that can be the hardest challenge.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's incredibly hard. But also, I think, it can seem from the outside that it's sort of a closed shop and, you have to know people and things. But actually, what I realise now from the other side is that the agents are always looking for good books, and if they come across, they're sent a book that they think they'll be able to sell, nobody's happier kind of thing. But it's just, it is getting that, getting it read, I guess, it's difficult because obviously they get so many.
Yeah, and then it must have been great getting such good feedback from Friend Request when it came out.
Yeah, it's been absolutely amazing, beyond my wildest dreams, really. The reviews, and just also, actually what's been wonderful has been the reader response, there's still, every day I get messages from people on Twitter and Facebook and through my website just telling me how much they've enjoyed it. And, I've even had some people who say they don't read very much, but they picked it up and really, really enjoyed it, which is lovely. I love it when I get messages like that from people that don't read much. I had one from a young woman in Australia who said she'd never read a book before and she'd really enjoyed it. That was just absolutely wonderful.
It's
been wonderful.
It's lovely when people take the time to let you know, because I bet millions of people out there don't. A lot of people will read a book and just go, I really enjoyed that, but not tell anyone, certainly not tell the author.
No. No, and I think perhaps they think we don't want to hear it, but, you know, we absolutely do. It's, it's lovely to get, you know, because otherwise you're sort of writing into a void. If you never get that feedback, you don't really know whether people are enjoying it or not.
Absolutely. So was it difficult to do the second book, kind of like a second album, as it were, as the first one did so well?
Definitely, yeah, that difficult second novel. yeah, definitely, it was a very different experience. You know, there was more pressure, because when I wrote Friend Request, I didn't know that anybody was ever going to read it, you know, no idea it would ever be published. And I was writing it, you know, at my own pace. And obviously with the second one, I had a deadline. As soon as I began it, I knew that my editor and my agent would be reading it. And obviously there was that pressure because, you know, obviously brilliant that From Request had done so well, but then you know that people are going to be looking at it when it comes out and thinking, oh, is it as good as the first? You know, the people that enjoyed the first one and inevitably are going to compare it. So, yeah, it was definitely pressure. It took me quite a long time to come up with the idea or to sort of refine the idea. But yeah, that's come out on the 28th of June in hardback and ebook in the UK. And so far, the feedback's been really good. So that's a relief.
Great. Yeah. So can you tell us, without giving too much away, what was that initial idea for this book?
Well, I mean, I kind of went around various ideas or sort of variations on what would become the idea. So what the story of this one is, it's about a young woman whose best friend goes missing, and the police said for various reasons are not taking it very seriously, but she has got good reason to fear that something has happened to her friend because of something in their shared past. So it's another one like From Request, where there are two timelines. So one is 10 years ago when they were sort of 18, and then the president there in their late 20s. So they were friends 10 years ago, the two girls, and they ended up having to give evidence at a rape trial of a friend of theirs. And as the story moves on, you kind of gradually start to find out who was lying back then, who's lying now, and obviously eventually leads us to find out what has happened to her best friend.
Mm-hmm.
In the first day.
So can you tell us a bit more about the characters, Ellen and Sasha?
Yeah, so when they meet, they are 16, in fact, when they meet, and Ellen comes from a fairly normal family, and Sasha is part of a new family that moves into a big house on the street. She's actually the goddaughter, so it's two parents with their sons, and Sasha is their goddaughter who lives with them. And they're this very glamorous, musical, bohemian family. The mum's an opera singer, the dad is a musician, and Ellen is kind of drawn into their world. I think a lot of people probably remember a family or a friend from their youth, but the family just seems so much more exciting than their own. And that's how Ellen feels. You know, they have all these glamorous parties and she really gets drawn into the world. And then 10 years later, she's still sort of slightly enthralled to Sasha, but as the book moves on, we start to realise that perhaps she doesn't know Sasha as well as she thought she did, and perhaps maybe Sasha needed her in ways that Ellen didn't really understand.
Mm, great. So did you find the process of writing the book any easier? Or I know you said you had a deadline to work to, obviously, with this, but did you enjoy it as much?
It was a different experience. Did I enjoy it as much? I'm not sure. I think I did. It was different, but I enjoyed it in a different way. Once I got going, it was difficult at the beginning because, as I say, we're kind of humming and hawing and going around with the ideas and the certain bits that my editor didn't like, so we're sort of chopping and changing. But once I got going, I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
I was probably more nervous, in a way, about it coming out than I had been about Friend Request.
And is it difficult with an editor if you've, obviously I know it's important to have a good relationship with your editor, but even so, after you've written something, if you think it's okay and then they say no, you need to get rid of that bit, is that hard to take?
To be honest, I've never found it hard to take. I love being edited. I love it. I love being told what to do. And I think I've never had an edit that I really disagreed with. I don't know what will happen if I do. I'm not sure how I would feel about that, but to be honest, everything that's ever been suggested to me, I've kind of thought, of course, that's much better. because with Three Little Lies, anyway, I presented what I sort of handed in was a very much a first draft. I hadn't really edited it myself. So I kind of, and I was kind of at the stage where I wanted fresh eyes on it. I wanted somebody else's take on it. And it wasn't like I thought it was perfect. I just had sort of got to the end of the point where, you know, I just really wanted another. So it's actually brilliant to get another perspective on it. And a perspective from somebody, you know, obviously my editor is vastly experienced and edits all sorts of amazing people and really knows what works and what doesn't. So, you know, I absolutely trust her.
Yeah. So have you already started on book three?
Yes, I have, yeah. I'm about halfway through a first draft, in fact.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's another psychological thriller, but a standalone, not a sequel.
Yeah.
To either of my first two. So it's about, well, it's hard to talk about because I haven't finished it, but it's...
Yeah, no, don't worry, you don't have to.
I don't mind. But I'm not doing a sort of two timeline for this one. So for the first, my first book where I haven't done a kind of dual timeline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are sort of, I guess, similar themes in that there are echoes of the past in what's going on in the present, but this one is pretty much all told in the present day. But it's about a woman who witnessed something really terrible as a very young child, which she barely remembers, but it's kind of defined the rest of her life, and people have always seen her as this sort of tragic toddler who witnessed this terrible thing, but then as she sort of starts to find out that maybe everything wasn't as it seemed.
Interesting. Well, before that, we've got Three Little Lies, which is out now and available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section, and it's by Laura Marshall, who we've been chatting to today. Laura, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
TRE. TRE.